Welcome to today's program titled The Anatomy of Trade Secret Audit. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen and type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for the webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Kate. You may begin.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everyone. We appreciate you taking the time to join our presentation today. And I have the pleasure of introducing my colleagues and also introduce myself, and then we'll kick off the program. I'm a partner in our Boston office. I'm also the chair of the National Litigation Department at Sipar Shaw, and most of my practice is focused on trade secret and non-compete litigation. Along with me today is my colleague Don Mertenite, also a partner in our Boston office, who dedicates a large portion of her practice to the to counseling and litigating trade secret and non-compete matters. Also on the panel today is my colleague and partner Justin Beyer from our Chicago office. He too, there's a common theme developing here, devotes a large portion of his practice to counseling and litigating trade secret and non-compete matters, counseling companies on the things that we're going to talk about today, actually. And then finally, last but not least, my colleague Andrew Stark, who is an associate in our Boston office and works on trade secret and non-compete matters with all the folks on this call with you today. So we welcome you. We hope you find this helpful. And I'm going to turn it over now to Andrew to kick off the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kate. So we'll begin with the agenda to describe the program and the number of topics that we're covering today. First, we'll begin by discussing some recent headlines that show the importance of adequate trade secret protections and companies' potential vulnerabilities if they become victims of trade secret theft or if they're faced with a lawsuit after hiring a new employee who may have taken stolen trade secrets with them. Second, we'll define trade secrets and give you some examples. Third, we'll discuss why you should protect your trade secrets by conducting a trade secret audit. And fourth, we'll define what a trade secret audit actually is. Fifth, we'll go through a recommended step-by-step audit process. And sixth and lastly, we'll summarize our recommendations and take any questions that you may have at the end. So to begin, as many of you may know, trade secret theft has been at the forefront of the government's and news media's attention for the past several years. As former President Barack Obama once said, quote, "Unfortunately, all too often, some of our competitors, instead of competing with us fairly, are trying to steal these trade secrets from American companies. And that means a loss of American jobs, a loss of American markets, and a loss of American leadership." Indeed, during President Obama's administration, Congress passed for the first time a federal trade secret cause of action called the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which for the first time provides a federal trade secrets cause of action as well as new remedies, including a seizure order. And fast forward to our current administration, as many of you are also aware, a focal point of the Trump administration's agenda has been to stop the theft of American trade secrets by foreign governments, which primarily includes China. As President Trump has said, quote, "If China does not stop its illegal activities, including its theft of American trade secrets, I will use every lawful presidential power to remedy trade disputes." And indeed, as we saw this spring in the front page news of many news outlets, that the Trump administration imposed $50 billion in tariffs on Chinese-made goods, which the Trump administration has expressly stated were imposed in large part due to the theft of American trade secrets by Chinese manufacturers. And just to show the gravity of the situation, the United States Trade Representative Agency led a seven-month investigation into China's intellectual property theft and concluded, quote, Chinese theft of American IP currently costs between $225 billion and $600 billion annually. For example, just this past January, a Chinese wind turbine manufacturer was slapped with an $800 million verdict in a Wisconsin federal court for stealing an American manufacturer's trade secrets. In sum, there, the Chinese manufacturer had agreed to partner with an American superconducting company on various wind power projects in which the Chinese manufacturer would build the turbines and the American superconductor would develop the software and technology that operated the turbines. Instead of paying the American superconductor company $800 million for the developed software and technology, however, the manufacturer's employees and a rogue American superconductor employee stole the American superconductor's software and technology, gave it to the Chinese manufacturer, which then backed out of the deal and used the stolen trade secrets to build its wind turbines. Now, this case, and as the few that I will discuss momentarily, serves as a firm reminder of the risks of your trade secrets being stolen and the importance of protecting them. Another important headline is the recently filed and potentially multi-billion dollar trade secret lawsuit by electric car company Faraday and Future, in which Faraday alleges that it hired two former BMW executives who then formed a rival electric car manufacturer while working for Faraday and systematically solicited at least 20 employees not only to leave Faraday but to copy and take highly valuable and proprietary trade secret information concerning its artificial intelligence technology. Now, the complaint alleges a scheme by these executives in which they were both hired by Faraday and then proceeded to embark upon what turned into be a failed coup d'etat of Faraday's CEO, founded their own electric car manufacturer, stole Faraday's trade secrets and employees, and resigned from the company all within the 2017 calendar year. And while this case is still only in the pleading stage, we're quite sure that it will develop into a hotly contested and expensive trade secret case. Another example is Waymo versus Uber, which was filed in 2017. In that case, Waymo sued Uber, alleging that a former Waymo employee took more than 14,000 files concerning self-driving car technology before leaving Waymo and starting his own self-driving truck company, which Uber later bought for $680 million. Waymo alleged in the lawsuit that the information stolen was worth over $2 billion. This case was heavily litigated for a year and ended up in a mid-trial settlement under which Uber reportedly gave Waymo a 0.34% equity stake worth approximately $245 million in Uber. And in another electric car case example, in 2017, Tesla sued its former employee after she quit to form her own self-driving car company called Aura. Tesla also sued Aura and its former employee, alleging that the former employee stole hundreds of gigabytes of confidential and proprietary information before leaving. That case settled, under which the former employee agreed to undergo future audits to ensure that she is not keeping or using Tesla's confidential information. And the settlement also established a process to allow Tesla to recover all of the alleged proprietary information that the former employee reportedly stole. Again, this, among the many other cases, serves as an important reminder of the trade secrets, of the risks of your trade secrets being stolen and the importance of protecting them. Now I'm going to turn this over to Kate Pirelli.
Hi, thanks, Andrew. As Andrew has highlighted with some of the headlines he's indicated, and as I'm sure you've all seen as you've looked at your favorite news outlets, companies are losing billions of dollars every year resulting from trade secret theft of their proprietary information. public companies that don't protect their trade secrets can face shareholder suits. Many are required to have these lists of trade secrets suits as part of disclosures to investors before funds are raised. Startups may never get off the ground if they're not able to secure their trade secrets and protect them. They won't be able to attract seed money and future capital to grow their companies. And just generally speaking, as the last bullet suggests here, market shares can be lost and prevented from being grown for companies. The damage can be costly. It can be catastrophic. And, you know, I don't mean to sound melodramatic, but if you take a look at the news every night, you can see some of the results of what happens when companies don't protect their trade secrets. We talk about the anatomy of a trade secret audit. You'll hear about the different component parts of the anatomy and throughout this presentation. But just starting with the premise that trade secrets are often the lifeblood of a company. It can be the most important. They can be the most important part, or perhaps one of many parts of the company's intellectual property. And although it's not the subject of this presentation today, IP can be protected, intellectual property or IP can be protected with a variety of mechanisms. Patents, trademark, and copyrights are the ones that are perhaps most known to the public. But there's also typically a treasure trove of other important company information that could qualify as a trade secret and therefore get protection under state and now federal law. If the information can be shown to have independent economic value and it's properly safeguarded by the company. Additionally, given the changes in the patent laws the last few years, of course, which we won't get into today, but there have been some significant changes within the patent laws, trade secret protection is now being looked to provide protections where patent laws may no longer protect particular forms of IP. So therefore, trade secret status can provide another and sometimes the sole layer of protection if the IP does not qualify as trademark, patent, or copyright protectable. Another important piece to keep in mind as we go through here is not only identifying the trade secrets, but preserving their trade secret status, because once they are disclosed, they're forever lost. You can't put it back in the safe, if you will. As mentioned, other IP protections, the trademark, copyright, and patent protections, those types of protections are, you know, registered with the government and complying with the statutory guidelines for those protections are what IP owners need to follow to make sure that they retain their protection. With trade secrets, there's no government registration or review. State statutes, and again, now a federal statute, which I'll talk about in just a moment, and case law interpreting those statutes define what is a trade secret and what's not a trade secret. But there's no real review of that status until a dispute arises and someone takes the trade secret and attempts to use it. So, and that typically, you're not the courts or what's interpreting what a trade secret is. And unless you put protections in place and identify the trade secrets in advance of those disputes, you may be defending them at a time in litigation where you have very little time to put your case together and very little time to demonstrate to the court that you've protected them to the point where they qualify as trade secrets. So you may find yourself either suing a former employee, a consultant, or a vendor, or a hacker who has stolen trade secrets, or your company may be defending a lawsuit from a competitor alleging that you've either conspired with a newly hired employee who's taken this former employer's trade secrets, or you haven't done enough to protect against the receipt of those into your company. So what we'll be talking about today is, again, the anatomy of a trade secret audit, why you do it, how you do it, the component parts of it, and we are hoping to position you and your companies to be in a position to identify, document, and protect your trade secrets before you're in the middle of a dispute like I just described. Next slide. So I mentioned the federal statute now. Back in 2016, the Defend Trade Secrets Act went into effect, also known as the DPSA, just for ease of reference. So we're going to take a bit of a look at that today. We're not going to go in deep detail. That's the subject of a lot of our other webinars and blog posts on our Trading Secrets blog, which I encourage you to take a look at these types of issues, and we'll have a reference to that at the end of the program. But let's start to think about what constitutes a trade secret so that you can properly identify them as you start your audits. I won't go into vivid detail on the DTSA because we don't have the time today, but in sum, it federalized trade secret law by creating a federal claim for trade secret misappropriation and created new remedies. In the past, before it was passed, each state had a form of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. Most states in the country, 48 of them other than New York and Massachusetts, had that, and New York and Massachusetts had other similar statutes aimed at protecting trade secrets and defining what they were. Therefore, there were 50 state approaches to what trade secrets were. There were common components to those laws, but the DTSA was aimed at trying to provide a consistent federal body of law on trade secret protection. I think the jury is out whether it's done that or not, but time will tell, and that's a subject for another presentation. But the DTSA provides a civil cause of action for trade secret theft. It also provides for protections for whistleblowers and some new remedies, the most important of which is an ex parte seizure of property remedy, which allows the plaintiff to seek a court's approval of seizing trade secrets without notice, obviously to prevent their disclosure before it happens. That's a mechanism that has actually not been widely used since the DTSA was enacted, but it is a very important remedy that's available to companies. And the last bullet here mentions this is being a reminder of the value of trade secrets. It's interesting that the passage of the DTSA was done by a rare, overwhelming bipartisan vote in Congress, which I think in and of itself highlights the value that the government has placed on protecting trade secrets and identifying them, and the need to put reasonable secrecy measures in place to protect them. So let's now go to what constitutes a trade secret. The DTSA has a definition in it. I won't read this all to you. It's rather dense. It has a very detailed list of categories. I think the count is 19 if you count them all, of all forms and types of information ranging from financial and business information to scientific, economic, and other types of information in various forms, whether they're patterns, compilations, program devices, and the list goes on there. Whether or how stored, compiled, or memorialized physically, electronically, graphically, or in writing, and there's a big if here, if and only if the owner has taken reasonable measures to keep such information secret, I'll come back to reasonable measures in just a minute, and the information derived independent economic value, actual potential from not being generally known to and not being readily ascertainable through proper means by the public. So let me go back to reasonable measures. Again, we could talk a long time about this, and the case law is developing on this, but reasonable measures typically are determined by the circumstances surrounding the size of the company, the type of company. So, for example, a mom-and-pop startup company is going to be held to a much different standard than a very large tech company, for example, that should know how to put reasonable measures in place and certainly have the means to do so, where a mom-and-pop startup may not. So this gives you just the statutory federal definition of trade secrets. The state laws are similar, perhaps not quite as comprehensive as this definition, but also provide an indicator on what the courts are going to look at in terms of determining whether a trade secret exists. And just some, just some examples, this next slide, of trade secrets. This is clearly not an exhaustive list when you think about it in contrast to the definition that we just showed you under the DTSA. but typically the types of things that we see in the cases that we handle. I think I won't take this in the order that they're in, but for example, detailed customer lists is something I know that the folks on this phone have litigated lots of cases around in the sales context, where salespeople have taken customer lists to a competitor or have gone off and started their own company and started calling on customers. This is, when you think about the definition that we just talked about, this is unique, secretive information. It's not phone book material, if you will. I've seen people back years ago holding up phone books in court saying that if the information is in here and it's the type of information, then it's in a book like this, it's not a trade secret. We've had folks talk about, and some commentators talk about, the five column rule, which is just a handy reference to think about your customer list as to what discrete categories of information are in those lists. If it's just name and address or information that's easily gleaned from public records, it's likely not going to qualify as trade secrets. Things like pricing preferences, unique contacts within the company, preferences in terms of orders and amount of orders, those types of things, which make it much more detailed, is going to make it much more likely to acquire trade secret status. Sensitive financial information is another common category of information being litigated these days under the DTSA, and when the U.S. Attorney's offices are involved in prosecuting trade secret theft, this is a little bit more difficult to establish than, for example, unique software and source code types of information, where courts and prosecutors are much more likely to think of those as trade secrets than they are of sensitive financial information. So it just gives you an idea of the types of things as you start to think about identifying your trade secrets, which is going to be a very important part of your trade secret audit process. So how best to make sure that you've identified all your trade secrets and have adequate protections in place to protect them? Lo and behold, while we're here today, you need to audit your information. Conducting a comprehensive audit of your company's policies, practices, types of IP under your company umbrella will allow you and put you in a position to put policies and procedures in place to protect them. We will be sharing, as we go through the program today, how to do that. We are also happy to share afterwards some information. We'll follow up after the presentation with some checklists to those who attended to put the pieces in place on your own, and certainly working with outside counsel makes good sense. Folks like us and others who litigate these cases all the time know what works and doesn't work under the case law and what courts are looking for, and are there to help you put adequate protections in place. So why? Well, you heard the headlines for sure. The amount of money being lost these days with trade secret theft, that's certainly a good reason to conduct a trade secret audit. And not only the changes that are going on in the United States, which we've talked about, the state laws and the DTSA, which we mentioned, but there's things going on in Europe and China and other parts of the world where they're addressing trade secrets. For example, the EU directive on the protection of undisclosed know-how and business information went into effect just recently, which was aimed at leveling the playing field for companies doing business in Europe by laying down common measures against unlawful acquisition and use and disclosure of intellectual property or trade secrets. The EU members' states are required to comply by that by May of this year. So for companies doing business globally, it's not just the United States laws that you need to be mindful, but also EU laws, and also, as mentioned here, China just had go into effect just first part of this year, an anti-unfair competition law, which is also aimed, just as the EU directive is, at leveling the playing field and defining trade secrets and putting reasonable measures in place, very similar to the requirements that are in place in the United States. I mentioned the changes in patent laws. Trade secret litigation is on the rise, just generally speaking, but also because of the change in the patent laws and the loss and protection under some of the patent laws in recent years, and cybercrime. every day you wake up and there's been a new event in the news of either a data breach or a hacking. I've heard all the stories about things being loaded up to WikiLeaks. So the list goes on. And unless you take steps to conduct an audit, you're not going to know what's under your umbrella and what needs to be protected. So both Andrew and I have talked a little bit about this already, but why do you do it? And what should be the three primary goals of it? I added one to this list. So there's four primary goals. And the number one, I think, which is not on this slide, is to know what you have. Many business units, and I think all of you out there in large companies or even small companies with different divisions, business units within a company often operate on their own independently of each other when they're developing IP. And the legal department doesn't know about it, the HR department doesn't know about it, and it's important to have a broad view of what the entire IP package is. And the audit will allow you to achieve that broadest view of what's happening under your organization's umbrella, what trade secrets you have, and what protections to put in place. And then to go to the slide, the first bullet, adequate protections from disclosure. As I mentioned, once disclosed, you can't claim trade secret status. It's lost. Number two, put yourself in the best position to sue. If you know what your trade secrets are in advance of a dispute, working with your outside counsel and asking your outside counsel to go in and get a temporary restraining order to prevent the disclosure, all you have to do at that point, if you've done your audit, is turn over to your outside counsel the list of your trade secrets, how you've protected them, rather than having to reinvent that wheel on the eve of having to file a lawsuit, which can be incredibly time-consuming and incredibly costly, and time is of the essence, of course, in these cases. And then finally, not quite finally, ensure that the company has taken adequate steps to protect itself in litigation, but also against claims from other companies that employees that you've hired have taken trade secrets and you've been using those to your benefit to stifle competition. By doing the audit, you'll know that whether or not you have proper internal controls in place to guard against new employees bringing in former employers' trade secrets. So I'm going to, I think one more slide here, Don, if you could advance. I'm just going to tick these up very quickly because Don and Justin will go through these steps. But the steps for an audit, quite simply, you have to plan in advance, put an overall project plan in place. Think of yourself as the architect for the plan and all the things that will have to go into place to build it. Communicate, make sure your key stakeholders and custodians of key information are helping you with the plan and involved from day one. Gather all the relevant information, which you'll hear about in this in the next presentations. Identify the trade secrets. Can't emphasize that enough. You have to know what you have. And then reviewing all your data, your policies, and other information, detecting any gaps in the organization's protection. And then, of course, remediating, taking steps to fix any major problems you have and gaps in protection. So I'll turn over to Dawn now to start with the steps.
Thank you, Kate. And before I start with the steps, I am going to read the CLE code. The code for this presentation is SS2408. That's S as in Seifarth, S as in Seifarth, 2408. So as Kate mentioned, there are a number of steps involved in a trade secret audit. On this slide, you'll see steps 1, 2, and 3, plan, communicate, and gather. So obviously, with a project of this scope and of this nature, it's important to have a comprehensive plan in advance that includes the scope of the audit, discrete steps, and a timeline for when all of those steps should be completed. And of course, once that plan is developed, it should be communicated with the key stakeholders. There should be at least one, if not multiple, individuals within the organization who will act as a liaison with outside counsel who's conducting the trade secret audit. And then it's also important to identify folks who would have relevant data or who will be impacted by the audit. Typically, we would expect that to be folks who are in HR, the legal department, IT, but there may be other groups and individuals who might have relevant information or who need to know the plan. And then, of course, once you've identified those individuals, you want to communicate the plan with the team so that they know what to expect and what is expected of them. Step three is to gather information that will help assist in conducting the trade secret audit. That would include, for example, any policies and procedures that the organization has to protect trade secrets, information generally regarding the company's protection of its trade secrets and confidential information, and other detail regarding the trade secrets, such as who has access to them, how often they're used, that sort of thing. So once you get through those first few steps, the next step is to identify the trade secrets. And Kate mentioned this a little bit, but I wanted to dive a little bit deeper on this. It seems to go without saying, but it should be said nonetheless, that in order to adequately protect your trade secrets, you need to understand what is a trade secret of the company and what's not really a trade secret. Not only does this help the company determine how best to protect that information, but it's also really important for employees and other business partners to understand what sorts of information needs to be protected. And you'd be surprised how easy it is for an employee to say truthfully or otherwise at the end of the day that they didn't understand a particular piece of information was that important to the company. So the more you can identify this up front, the easier it will be to protect the information and to make sure your employees and business partners understand that it's entitled to protection. The added benefit of this exercise is that in certain jurisdictions, when a party brings a claim for misappropriation of trade secrets, they have to identify with a certain amount of specificity what those trade secrets are before the case can proceed. California is a good example where there's a lot of trade secret litigation, and this is one of the first steps. And again, it would seem like it wouldn't be terribly difficult to pull this information together, but you'd be surprised how many companies really struggle, especially when they're trying to rush into court. As Kate mentioned, these cases move pretty quickly. When you're trying to rush into court and you're trying to grapple with what exactly is the trade secret at issue in the litigation, it's much easier if you've already gone through this exercise and have pretty well-defined trade secrets. I won't go through all of this because it was covered a bit in Kate's section, but you have to keep in mind what actually qualifies for trade secret protection under the various statute or case law in the jurisdiction you're operating in. It doesn't need to be information that's novel or unique. It can be the sort of thing that multiple companies have a similar type of trade secret, but the company needs to make sure that the information is not publicly published. It's not available to just anyone out in the world. It can be made up of information, as Kate mentioned, that by itself is not a trade secret, but in conjunction with other pieces of information, the way it's put together and combined in a unique manner renders it a trade secret. And of course, you need to take reasonable steps to maintain the secrecy of the trade secret, which we'll talk about a little bit later. So step five is the review process, which is a pretty big step. There are a couple different components to the review process. One is to review the company's protection agreements, and we'll talk about the sorts of agreements that might come into play here, and to make sure that those agreements are up to date and take into consideration current developments in the law, current developments in technology, and the like. The other part that we'll talk about is the security measures that the company uses in addition to its agreements. So just to talk about the agreements themselves, there are a variety of different types of employee agreements that are often recommended. I've listed a number of them here. Obviously, confidentiality agreements are a key component to a trade secret audit in determining what the company has put in writing as far as employees or other individuals' obligation to keep materials confidential. There's also a return of materials agreement, which signifies to employees that when they leave the company, they need to return the company's information. That's obviously important, not only as a signal to the employees, but also to show, God forbid you're ever in front of a court dealing with a misappropriation claim, to show that you put the employees on notice and that you took the steps to make them aware that they had to return this information. Invention assignment agreements also can come into play here. Restrictive covenants agreements, there are a number of different components of these. We're all presumably familiar with non-compete provisions, customer and employee non-solicit provisions, no hire provisions, and non-disclosure provisions of restrictive covenants agreements, which obviously go hand in hand with confidentiality agreements in general. So when you're looking at these agreements, there are a number of things to consider. First and foremost, of course, any new legal developments. So if you are operating in a jurisdiction, and in many cases, even if the company doesn't have headquarters or an office in a particular jurisdiction, a certain jurisdiction might be implicated just by virtue of where the company's customers are or its employees are, and you need to consider any legal developments that have come about in those jurisdictions, whether by statute or by case law. If a company moves its corporate headquarters to a different city or state or even country, that obviously will also impact the enforceability of any agreements that are in place. Same with mergers and acquisitions. We see this a lot in trade secret litigation. When a company acquires another company, how the two companies deal with their varying agreements and which agreement is operative going forward. So that's something to be mindful of. New business partners. So this is something I wanted to mention because we talk a lot about employee agreements, which are obviously very important, but Andrew mentioned earlier one of the more recent cases involving a purported business partner that absconded with the trade secrets of the company. So it's important to remember that you're not just entrusting employees with your information, but you're also oftentimes entrusting your business partners and vendors with that information. So you need to be mindful of that. And each individual organization has different needs for their agreement. So a trade secret audit should take into consideration the type of organization, its trade secrets, and any specific components that are really unique to that company. So the next thing to review is the company's security measures. So for example, a company can have plenty of agreements with their employees, business partners, vendors, but if they're not taking additional steps to protect the trade secrets of the organization, those agreements aren't really worth that much. So one thing to consider is ways to minimize a bad actor's availability to misappropriate the company's trade secrets. And we've listed here a number of different ways, from low-tech methods such as copying, photocopying documents, to emailing from your company email to a personal email certain documents that are that reveal trade secret information, downloading such information to external devices such as USB drives, uploading information to the cloud. And again, that's a good example of why it's important to take into consideration new technologies, because, you know, 15 years ago we weren't talking about cloud uploading, and now that's something that you really need to think about. Physical security is something that often is overlooked because we are in a high-tech society and we think about all the things we need to do with our computers and our other network systems, but it's important to remember that if there are documents, hard copy documents with trade secret information on them, they shouldn't be left out in the open. They should be put away in files and kept from any old person who can walk in the door and take a look at them. Obviously, it is important to think about information security, things like password protection, limiting certain databases to employees or business partners what they need to know, and generally having data policies that protect information. I saw a question come in about how to mark trade secrets as such. This is a good time to talk about that. It is always beneficial to mark a document with confidential. Sometimes if you have an Excel spreadsheet, for example, it's difficult to do that, but you can always put in the file name that it's confidential. If you don't do that, it doesn't mean that the document isn't confidential, but it certainly makes it much easier to make the case to a court if this ever ends up in litigation that the document this employee or business partner absconded with is actually confidential because it's stamped right on there or in the file name. I wanted to talk about training. This is very important and it's something that should be considered in the audit process. Again, part of this is so that your employees actually do understand that this information is important, is very valuable to the company, and must be kept secret. Another part of that, again, is so that you can later say to a court, if need be, if it gets in front of a judge, we have these trainings every year. So when employee John Smith says, oh, no one ever told me this was important, you can easily show that it was actually conveyed to employees and other individuals. And same with onboarding and exit interview procedures. When employees come in, you should have procedures in place that let the incoming individual know that it will not be tolerated if they took trade secrets from their former employer, and it will not be tolerated if they leave with trade secrets or otherwise share them during their employment. And when they leave, you want an exit interview process that again reminds them of the agreements they signed, the importance of this information, and any issues that will arise if they try to disclose that information. And finally, just a reminder that in addition to IT policies and employee agreements, vendor agreements, it's also important as part of the trade secret audit process to talk about the things you should be looking for beyond agreements and your IT policies. If you have an employee or a business partner who is snooping around and trying to get information on something that's not relevant to their job description, that's important to know. If they have an unusual use of company equipment, or they're sending documents home with them more than they really should or without authorization, if they're coming in at odd hours, bringing recording devices, all that is very important, and it's something that key individuals in the organization should be mindful of. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Justin, who's going to talk about step six and beyond.
Thanks, Dawn. So part and parcel for your examination of the various agreements and your review of those documents, you want to really be mindful of looking into what could be perceived as gaps in your trade secret protection program. A large portion of any trade secret audit is going to focus, you know, very, very clearly on the agreements that already exist. But questions that you should be asking when you go through those type of agreements are, you know, are the agreements insufficient? You know, and what I mean by that is, you know, has your business changed over the years and the things that you're looking to protect through those agreements are possibly no longer state of the art for your company? Are the agreements unenforceable? Were they written at a particularized time where your state permitted unlimited geographic restrictions, or, you know, years of time that maybe otherwise may otherwise not be appropriate now, and so you want to be looking for those. That also kind of goes to the outdated agreement section. You also want to, though, be looking at other aspects of your program, they may not be focused entirely on the agreements end of things. And those really are going to be what we focus on over the next few slides. And that's really the question of inadequate security measures and outdated technology. Don just touched on the lack of training or the training that one could, you know, what a company could utilize in looking to protect these. Sorry. So we're constantly faced as lawyers, who represent companies, with new technologies. And to a certain extent, that can be addressed through the agreements that we craft, where we're not maybe focusing entirely on specific classes of devices or certain email domains or things of that nature, but trying to be more generalized in the information that we're seeking to protect. But in many instances, the means by which companies seek to protect their information needs to develop along with that technology. Prime example, you know, agreements that were written 10 years ago, 12 years ago, were not contemplating the means by which smartphone technology has developed. You know, simply put, the vast majority of employees in companies these days have access to sensitive company-related information through an iPhone, through an Android device. There is a very unfortunate technique that is available where you can open up an email in one browser, essentially, on your iPhone. You can open up your company's email that may contain sensitive information. You can change the sending domain to a personal email account, and you can hit send. And you will suddenly have taken that information from the employer and put it on your personal email account, and there is really no way to track that. And so that is a very much meant to be a boogeyman type scenario, but it demonstrates the very real concern that exists with the development of technology. Another prime example that I want to say that Don touched upon briefly was the fact that cloud computing is now something that is a very real issue and available technology. And people can upload information into the cloud with relative ease, and some of that information is not very easily trackable. So the question is that, you know, what are you doing, or how can you go about attempting to identify your risk centers, prime risk, and this is still the case, you know, irrespective of changing time, are employees with flash drives or external hard drives and personal email accounts. And, you know, I think I can speak for all of Andrew, Kate, and Dawn when I say that in so many scenarios where we deal with litigation, what we are looking at is the use of trade secret information or the misappropriation of trade secret information through the use of personal email accounts and flash drives. And so there are both low-tech and high-tech ways to try to prevent that. One low-tech way is in coming up with your training or your security protocols, you prohibit employees from using personal email accounts on their computers. There are ways from an IT perspective where you can ban the use of certain website or domain addresses. So, for example, if you have concern about it, you could theoretically block, you know, mail.yahoo.com or, you know, Google Mail or other applications that would allow someone to have access to trade secret information through personal through their personal email account. A low-tech way to prevent flash drives from being used is I've legitimately seen companies take super glue and super glue over the USB ports on computers to prevent someone from placing that into a computer. There are high-tech ways to do that too. There is certain tracking software that looks into that type of thing. There are forensic investigations that can occur after someone leaves. But the reality is that we live in an age in which information can be obtained relatively easily through cell phone cameras or iPhones. People can quickly disseminate information through social networking sites. There's Reddit accounts. You can do it through the black web. So I mean, there are a variety of ways that companies can be both proactive and reactive to deal with these type of things. The point of all this is that when you are engaged in trade secret litigation, one of the primary questions that a court is asking is whether or not the company has taken reasonable measures to protect the trade secret nature of the information. And that doesn't mean it has to be Herculean, but it has to be something. And so when you're conducting these trade secret audits, you want to be mindful of the steps that the company is taking, and you want to be able to document the steps that the company has taken from a security standpoint. I have seen a number of courts in recent years who have taken the approach that simply requiring employees to have passwords on computers by itself is insufficient to demonstrate that you're taking reasonable security measures. It used to be 10 years ago that was, that was a fail-safe. You put that in a pleading and that was a no-brainer. Now courts want to see, do you have agreements in place? Do you have those passwords? Are you restricting access on a need-to-know basis? Provide training to employees, demonstrate to them what is a trade secret and why that information shouldn't be shared? Are you conducting onboarding interviews? Are you conducting exit interviews? Do you have some measure in place to make sure that electronic devices are being accounted for and returned to companies? So the long and short of it is there is no one-step fits all for companies, but in considering what makes sense for your client or for your personal company, you should be taking these into consideration. Additional things that you may want to consider, there are questions that always arise about ownership of data and continuity of access to data. And that happens in a number of situations it can happen through social media accounts. For example, there's a whole line of cases that have recently developed about who owns Twitter accounts or who owns access to Facebook pages that are being operated by companies. And so in attempting to also demonstrate the security of the data, you also have to be mindful about those ownership interests. Some other things that you may want to consider are survival provisions in your agreements and in your intellectual property agreements. And what I mean by that is there are a number of times where it may be appropriate to have a lag time for which a former employee may not develop a intellectual property that is similar to what they've been working on with the company. Other things you may want to keep in mind is diversification of your data centers and a backup plan. This is to really more prevent issues with potential hackers, which can be utilized to show that you're not taking your trade secrets seriously. Other things is, are you contracting with third parties that are going to have access to your information? This could be an independent contractor. This could be a vendor. This could be someone through through the due diligence process of a possible M&A transaction. So you have to be mindful of who's getting access to your information and in what way and what are the best means possible or necessary to protect that information. And so the final step is actually putting a plan in place. And so you've already gone through these questions about prohibiting disclosure of company trade secrets, is there going to be an individual or committee responsible for putting this into place? I will tell you that in my experience, it's usually not a committee. It's generally speaking the HR department who gets tasked with this, but there are some ways to divvy up those responsibilities. Have you put in regular training sessions to inform people what trade secrets are and how to protect them? Do you have a plan in place through training, agreements, security for protecting confidentiality? Equally important to that is employees who are coming on and leaving. You want to make sure that no one's bringing in information they shouldn't have or taking information when they leave. And then finally, it's important for companies to perform these type of audits on a somewhat regular basis. And I'm not suggesting it has to be every 6 months or every year, but every so often companies should be considering what precisely the state of the law looks like. So to sort of wrap this up from a summary standpoint, you really want to be sure that coming out of this, you are prepared either as a company or as outside counsel to be helping companies update confidentiality agreements or looking to someone who has that capacity. Looking at computer usage policies, whether that be in an employee handbook or an independent policy. Want to make sure that there are, you know, strong control measures that are in place so that the president of the company and a low-level employee don't have access to the same information. Again, there are a variety of software that is available that can do that, but there's also other privacy things that can happen as well. And then looking into and making sure that your hiring and your departure procedures make sense. And then finally, the using technology as appropriate and as cost effective as necessary for your company to protect that information. So we've had a few questions that have come in during the course of this afternoon, and we're going to quickly take an opportunity to respond to those. We have one question from Logan, and that is, are there any extra steps you can recommend for a company that has mostly independent contractors? That's a tough one in the sense that independent contractors, there are some restrictions on what you can do from a restrictive covenant standpoint, but all independent contractors can be bound by confidentiality agreements. I think in those scenarios, you probably want to have as robust of an agreement in place with those independent contractors and as well certain technological limits. For example, you may not want to have independent contractors hooked up to to your company's network. You may want to only provide them with certain information on a very need-to-know basis. So that would be one step you could, or a couple different steps that you could utilize. We also have a question from Megan. What are some best practices for updating employment agreements to accommodate some of your suggested provisions, especially where it would be considered a restrictive covenant? There's no simple answer to that, Megan. Some of this is going to depend on the state in which you find yourself. Some states, such as California, for example, have taken very hardline approaches to what type of post-employment restrictive covenants are appropriate. I will tell you that from a trade secret standpoint, however, almost every state in the country, and I can't think of a state that doesn't allow protections to exist for the continued protection of trade secrets. That includes California, where, for example, you would be permitted to attempt to stop someone from competing to the extent that it was going to disclose your trade secrets. But for the most part, confidentiality agreements are probably your easiest and best way to protect confidential information. Return of property agreements, intellectual property assignment agreements, those can all be embedded in an employment agreement that doesn't necessarily have to contain a non-solicit or a non-compete. And it looks like Megan is in Illinois. Megan, if you want to follow up with me via email, I'm happy to answer some more questions on that front. But it looks like we have reached the end of the questions. If there's no other questions that have come in the interim, we've reached the end of today's presentation. On behalf of Kate Pirelli, Dawn Merton-Knight, Andrew Stark, and myself, we want to thank you for taking the time this afternoon to join us. You are always welcome to visit. Seyfarth Shaw has a cutting edge trade secret. We do these webinars on a semi regular basis, but on top of that, we have an award winning blog, which pumps out content on a fairly regular basis. And we would encourage you to visit that for any of your questions on trade secret law, or to contact us directly. So on behalf of everyone again, thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.